Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Time is running out. That's the message from Dr. Gunelle Rodier of the World Health Organization, who today said that if the source of Europe's new virulent strain of E. coli isn't found soon, we may never know the cause. The outbreak has killed at least 22 in Germany and sickened more than 2,000 across Europe. First, authorities blamed cucumbers, then bean sprouts. Both have been cleared. And today, the EU announced $220 million in compensation to farmers. But the trail is cold. And there's other food news here in the U.S. A plate has replaced a pyramid as the government's new food icon. So it's time to call in Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. She also writes the blog Food Politics and was a nutrition policy advisor to the Department of Health and Human Services back in the 1980s, well-versed in these outbreaks. Marion, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And let's start with E. coli first. Why is this so hard to trace?
Well, it's very difficult. If you're asking people who are sick what they ate, first of all, they have to remember what they ate some time ago, probably maybe 3-4 days, something like that. And they went around and interviewed people, and most of the people who were sick from this particular form of E. coli remembered eating salads. And so they did a sort of careful investigation of cucumbers, tomatoes, and lettuce, and 95% of the people who got sick had eaten one of those. But everybody eats those things every day.
Well, and you're saying that it's this difficult detective work, but then you have Dr. Michael Osterholm of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Montana, who said on MSNBC, all this wishy-washy back and forth, this is incompetence. And there's a thinking that Europeans appear to rely on bacterial cultures instead of tracing what people eat. What does that mean to you?
Well, I actually looked at the epidemiological investigation that the equivalent of the CDC in Germany did. It looked like a completely reasonable investigation to me.
Is this just inevitable with so much food being produced in such bulk as opposed to the way it was 200 years ago? Or maybe, you know what, maybe there were E. coli outbreaks 200 years ago that, you know, we certainly didn't hear about.
Not this kind. These outbreaks are new. These are bacteria that are largely antibiotic resistant, and they're bacteria that have evolved as a result of the very, very close conditions on industrial farm animal producing facilities. But we know what to do to prevent these things. And that's following standard food safety procedures that the FDA in the United States has just gotten congressional authority to start imposing on food producers. But of course, they don't have the resources to do it. So I think this is something that we're sort of braced for here. If it can happen there, it certainly can happen here.
And we've talked in the past about industrial farming, the problems with waste disposal, the problems with animals.
And
so you're saying that
there's no really nice way to say this. This is a problem of animal waste contaminating vegetables. But there's something very special about these particular types of E. coli bacteria. They don't make the animals sick, but they make people who eat them very, very sick. And you just simply cannot underestimate how sick this is making so many people. I can't imagine that they have enough kidney dialysis machines in Germany to take care of all these people.
Well, and I just want to have added, you say that following the guidelines will help, but I can just hear the voices saying, and also going back to small farming and local food will help as well. Let's move to the new food plate. We've got a picture at hereandnow.org where we're also asking listeners to send in their photographs of their dinner plates. You know, just take it on your iPhone if you can and send it to us. Does your dinner plate match the new recommendation? And to remind people what that recommendation is, it's a plate divided into roughly 4 quarters with a cup off to the side. A half of the plate is fruit and vegetables. The other half is grains and protein. The grains quarter of the plate is a little bigger than the protein, and dairy is in a cup off to the side. First of all, just briefly, most people know, but how does this compare to the history of the pyramid before the plate?
Well, there were only two pyramids. The first was in 1992, and it showed that at the top of the pyramid were the foods you were supposed to eat less of, junk foods and meat and dairy products, and at the bottom were grains, and then above them fruits and vegetables. And there were two complaints about that pyramid. The meat industry and dairy industry complained that their foods were at the top of the pyramid where you weren't supposed to eat more of them, and they were complaining that the government was advising eating less of their commodities, and they didn't like that. And then nutritionists were upset about the pyramid because it called for 6 to 11 servings of grain, which is of grain foods a day, which is fine if you're eating Department of Agriculture defined servings, 1 ounce each. But not so fine if you're eating 6 bagels, each of which is 5 servings all by itself.
Not so good. And by the way, I should say, before the pyramids, there were food guidelines. And you say overall, except for that 1992 exception, the food guidelines have always stressed the importance of meat and dairy foods. In fact, the meat industry was so upset with the 1992 one that didn't stress meat as much that it was pulled. And now here we are on this plate. Your initial thoughts on just the plate and the layout?
Well, I liked it. I mean, it's really simple to understand because the 2005 pyramid that replaced the controversial 1992 one was just streams of colors coming down from a triangle. I called it foodless and useless. Didn't have any food on it. You needed a computer to understand what it meant. This one is going to be really simple to teach. You have somebody in your office. You show them a plate. You say half of this is supposed to be fruits and vegetables. These are what we mean by fruits and vegetables. And you're off and running. And then the only issue is the size of the plate. You just have to keep the plate small.
Right, not a platter. But you do have a criticism about the corner that's labeled protein.
That's because I'm a nutritionist. All of the things on the plates are foods, except for that. That's a nutrient. Protein's a nutrient. And protein is not missing in American diets. Most Americans have twice as much protein as they need. I understand why the Department of Agriculture did that. They don't want to call it meat when that corner is supposed to be either meat, poultry, fish, or beans. But grains and dairy are also sources of protein. So it's confusing.
It is confusing, and it's also angering people who think, hey, wait a minute, if you call that corner, which most Americans think of as the meat corner, even though, as you said, it includes fish and beans, then what you're doing is relabeling meat protein.
Yes, and of course the meat industry adores that. They've tried for years to get Americans to equate meat with protein. And that's why the meat industry has embraced this food guide as much as it has.
Well, just a couple quick questions on that, though. Could protein also include, protein shakes, protein bars?
Oh, yeah, sure. Wait until you start seeing protein advertised now. Everybody is going to advertise that they've got protein in it and it meets your food group.
And Marion, the vegan group, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, agrees with you. They have the same plate, except instead of meat and fish in that protein corner, they label it legumes, beans.
They have always put out food guides for vegans that don't have any animal products on them at all. Their plate is beautifully designed and looks remarkably like the one that the Department of Agriculture just put out, only theirs came first.
Well, and they also say that the new plate couldn't be more at odds with federal food subsidies. You write about this as well. What is that about?
Well, it's a great anomaly. Here is one branch of the Department of Agriculture telling people that they ought to have half their plate as fruits and vegetables, when Department of Agriculture subsidies go 99% to other foods, corn, soybeans, and animal feed, foods like that. Fruits and vegetables get only 1% of agricultural subsidies. So we need to bring our agricultural policy in line with health policy.
And we know a lot of corn is going into sodas. That brings us to the recommendations that come with the plate. The plate doesn't stand alone. They also say, when it comes to grains, make at least half of your grains whole grains. But tell us again, why are whole grains better than...
Well, they have the nutrients, and processed, highly refined grains are essentially the same as sugar in the body. They just immediately are digested into glucose and raise blood sugar levels. And I love the statements that that go with the new food guide. The first one is enjoy your food but eat less. Imagine the Department of Agriculture saying that you should enjoy your food. What a concept.
And they also say to reduce your sodium in soups and breads, frozen meals, and drink water instead of sugary drinks. But you point out that there are naturally sweetened drinks that shouldn't be lumped in with sugary drinks.
Yeah, I think it's okay for people to be drinking juices, just not in very large quantities. So all of this is always a question of moderation and proportion.
And lastly, let's touch on the cup that's off to the side of the plate. Andrew Bellotti, who writes the Small Bites blog, doesn't like it. The cup is supposed to be for your dairy or yogurt allotment. And he says if the USDA were truly concerned with calcium intake, rather than returning the financial favor to the dairy industry, it would make a calcium-rich food group. So you'd have kale, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, along with cheese and milk. Is this, in your mind, as Andrew Bellotti says, a lobbying triumph?
Well, it's hard to know. It seemed to me there was less evidence of lobbying on this particular food guide than we've seen in the past. But the dairy industry has long convinced the Department of Agriculture that dairy is an essential nutrient, which it most definitely is not. One of the great anomalies about the calcium issue is that people who consume the most dairy foods have the most osteoporosis from an epidemiological perspective.
Because?
Well, it's not clear exactly, but one part of it may be that the rest of the nutrients that come with dairy foods don't allow the calcium to be absorbed into bones as much as it does from other kinds of foods. And there are plenty of people who do not eat dairy foods at all who have very strong bones. The example that I like to give is cows. Cows don't drink milk, and yet they have bones that support 800,000-pound weights. All they do is eat grass. There's plenty of calcium in grass. You just have to eat really a lot of it.
Well, Mary Nussel, overall, what do you think of the idea that, I mean, what you just said, common sense. And we hear from listeners all the time. They're on the website right now saying this whole thing, the idea that you have to be shown a dinner plate and you have to be shown vegetables and fruit and, you know, have less meat and more whole grains, is ridiculous. It's a nanny state at its best. Everybody knows how to eat.
Well, I wish that were true. We live in a country where obesity has become a national problem, and as Secretary Tom Vilsack said at the launch of this new guide, obesity is not just a matter of personal appearance. It's a matter of national security. It's a matter of health care costs, and it's a matter of our economic productivity. I don't think people are deliberately trying to make themselves sick. I think they really don't know.
Mary Nussel, separate from the plate, yesterday we talked about January's USDA proposals regarding school lunches. And one of the suggestions, although it's considered a pretty strong suggestion, is to eliminate white potatoes from breakfast and limit them in school lunches. Republicans have just filed a bill to overturn these new school lunch guidelines. They say they're too costly. We also have spoken to people from the states that produce potatoes who say it's not the potatoes, it's all the stuff people put on potatoes, and it's the French fries that schools make. But are you saying when you make your comment about whole grains that, in fact, potatoes really aren't as good for you as, let's say, a whole grain?
Well, the concern about potatoes is that they're very starchy and the starch is turned into sugars in the body. But if you eat whole potatoes with the peel and all, you're getting very important nutrients with it. I happen to like potatoes. Everything is in proportion. I think the big issue in school lunches is all the sugary foods. Here's where lobbying really does come in, because the makers of processed foods are lobbying very, very hard to have their foods approved as part of the school lunch. If the potatoes were real, I'd say leave them in.
But in fact, they're processed and fast frozen and French fried
and dehydrated and reconstituted. I mean, we think we need to get back to food. This is a matter of the health of the future of our nation. I don't understand why this is a place where anyone would want to cut corners.
Mary Nussel, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. She also writes the blog Food Politics. Marion, as always, a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure's all mine.